Light, which is electricity, is the universal rhythm to which our bodies are connected in the harmony of music vibrating through the distant reaches of space. Many are still dormant, their souls not yet awakened to the quest nor aware of the magic force within to seek into the furthermost glories of nature. These are a prelude to the everlasting contact with the intelligent universe, as the soul taps the knowledge and wisdom to transmit it to the mind. Wisdom is born in many who know these things through their enlightened souls. It does not come from the reading of innumerable books and literature, which merely hold the beliefs and ideas of others who have not always spent their time in the quest for truth. A different kind of people must evolve on Earth. A new species of humans must appear. People of understanding, love and tolerance, who are set on life rather than violence and death, who will become the sons and daughters of their God, the sons and daughters of the universe in harmony with all nature. Only in this way can there be a prelude to the salvation of their world, their earth, fragile and beautiful, floating alone and vulnerable in the vast void of darkest space, yet shining with a blue light like a beacon of hope. I thought of all the other planets in our solar system harboring the form of humankind. I thought of how Venus, the mother planet, had given birth to humankind, her beauty unspoiled by the human hand but reduced to desert by the radiation from her star, the Sun. No wonder we feel an affinity with Venus, the mother planet who created so many of us in the dim and distant past. So many people have written of their experiences with Venusian space people in vintage spaceships, and this is indeed so. It is only natural for them to refer to Venusians and Saturnians, because all space people originated from planets in this solar system. The Sun's system is over 5 billion years old and is indeed the cradle of humankind. It is simpler for the minds of people on Earth in the present time to expand in the knowledge of their own solar system first. This has been necessary in order to condition them to the greater truths to come. They now have to realize that human beings have lived on Earth before, more than 50,000 years ago, and as they perfected their science and technology, they were able to move out to a neighboring solar system in the constellation of Centaurus. This great civilization's people are still referred to as Venusians, house-ever, a tall, fair-skinned people with high foreheads and golden hair. This is Akan's civilization, and I can remember, through race memory, my life on Venus in a previous incarnation. Akan has awakened this memory within my mind and it all comes back with lucid remembrance. Sometime in the future, I shall write a sequel to this book, which I shall call Daughter of Venus, for indeed, I am a true daughter of Venus and not of Earth. Perhaps I was planted here as a child, because I do not resemble my family here physically, mentally or spiritually. It is quite natural for me to be a part of Akan's civilization instead of this Earth civilization. Even Akan said to me once, "Why do you refer to May as your sister? She is not a blood sister." The link of adaptation was between Venus and Earth, and now it is between Meton and Earth, the home planet in the system of Alpha Centauri. In that moment of thinking, my being had contacted the essence of infinity, and the truth was revealed in all its wonder. Time was the essence and the answer to it all. The passage of time was of no consequence to Akan's civilization. Thousands and thousands of years pass unnoticed in the scale of universal knowledge. Earth people need to understand the eons of time, as they do not yet live long enough to mature and attain great wisdom and knowledge. Wisdom and knowledge are born of time's soft-lessness, as all events in a solar system are interrelated. The variability of time is of consequence to Akan's civilization. They use it and control it for the benefit of their science. I felt sure that Akan would tell me more about it when next we met. Quietly I got up out of the long grass and walked down the contour path back to the hostel hidden in the trees. Selin was already bed-soft-did down safely in the stable for the night with the other horses, and I arranged with the groom to have them ready at dawn to leave for the high plateau. I warned my son of what we must do, As the darkness of a moonless night closed in around the hostel and we sat out on the terrace looking toward the heights of Cathkin. The next morning we moved slowly in single file up the steep and winding path. We topped the mountain to the high plateau as the sun rose over the rolling hills of Natal far below, bathing the grassy slopes of Cathkin with a golden light. Increasing our pace as we reached the plateau, we saw the mighty battlements of Cathkin rising sheer into the clear blue of the morning sky. The rose rock was seamed and scarred from centuries of weathering, forever gazing into the eternity of space, and the lower slopes were alive with a mantle of green grass bowing and waving in the wind. Suddenly, the mare in front shied off the trail in a frantic effort to escape from the unknown. She almost unseated David, who recovered instantly to control and calm her. Celine snorted, flaring her nostrils, and stopped dead in her tracks. There's Ula Grum, riding one horse and leading the great pack horse behind, shouted a command to the horses as he leapt to the ground to try and quiet the terrified animals. But they stood trembling and snort soft hyphening, showing the whites of their eyes. I immediately jumped from Celine, instructing David to dismount as well, and spoke urgently to the groom in his own tongue to lead the horses some distance away. Then, across the trail in front of us, Akan's great spaceship shimmered into view. First, a heat wave effect moved over the flattened grass, and then the glowing ship appeared, hovering low and gradually settling to land on the trail. Further back, the Zulu groom stood rooted to the spot, his mouth opening and shouting. He attempted to shout something to us, but his mind was quite unable to absorb the scientific explanation of the light-bending effects of the unified field. Here was magic indeed at the foot of the Rain Mountain. All his life he had watched how the clouds gathered to bring the rain to the lands of his people on the rolling hills below. He had seen how the mountain trapped the moisture in the air, creating clouds to bring the rain spreading outward along the vast escarpment and away across the hills to the sea. Now the magic of the mountain has brought something else, something beyond his simple understanding. A spaceship from the wider universe suddenly appeared before his terrified gaze and quietly came to rest upon the trail he knew so well. Silently, the spaceship remained, and without a sound the doorway opened. Akan stepped through, and with a happy cry of welcome I was gathered up in his arms. You can never capture the spaceship or its crew. How wonderful was that glorious morning spent with Akan! His heel soft hyphening hands smoothed away the seeds of tiredness from my body after the long ride. My fatigue was of short duration, and the sustenance he gave us restored my strength. My life was whole in its unity with Akan, and we had created another life to complete this wholeness. I now relaxed in complete happiness as I sensed the stirring of his child in my womb. It was the first vigorous movement of a strong and healthy son, who seemed to sense already the proximity of his sire as Akan placed his hand on my tummy to feel the beating of his heart. You will be safe now, until I fetch you, Akan said softly as he walked with me over to the horses. You will know when and where to wait for me. Quieting the horses with his hands and voice, he lifted me into the saddle and stroked Celine's neck. She is sure-footed, smooth and comfortable. The rhythmic exercise is good for both of you, and above all, this fresh air up here is full of oak-sigh soft hyphen gen. But do not get tired. With that stern command, he kissed me tenderly and turned back to his spaceship. It seemed that David and the groom did not exist. He took no notice of them. A shimmer-like, heat wave effect played along the ground and shifted up into the sky, and the great spaceship had gone. I knew Akan had knowledge that others were in the vicinity, others whose covetous minds kept them ever on the move, others who came from elsewhere on this planet to seek and find the spaceship, to probe its method of propulsion by ruthless means. They would have magnetic instruments with them. Quickly, I called out. We must go back into the mountain. Turning Celine, I put my heels into her sides. Annoyed, she leapt forward tossing her head and sped away, the others following. When we reached the top of the escarpment, I looked back as the mists began to clear, revealing the winding trail our horses had negotiated with little strain or difficulty. The trail wound down, skirting the stream bank, through an easy pass to the high plateau below. On either side, the magsoft-nificent cliff faces of Champagne Castle appeared through the thinning clouds. The great flat top of Cathkin reared above the swirling mists like a sentinel, remote and aloof, apart from the main escarpment, with the peak of Mount Memory piercing the moving clouds beyond. Dismounting, I slipped the bit out of Celine's mouth and fastened the reins to my saddle so that she could drink from the clear stream with calm soft-fort and graze the fresh grass on the bank. I then walked along the sloping plateau of the main escarpment and looked over toward the mountainous country of Basuto land. Some time ago, a mountain fire had been sparked off somewhere in the fastnesses of Basuto land by a woman throwing out the hot embers of a cooking fire. It had swept with the west wind over and down the escarpment on the natal side and through the rich, seeding grass covering the slopes of Cathkin. It was only halted by an old firebreak down the mountainside, leaving the high plateau beyond untouched by the destructive breath of fire. My feet crunched into the burnt grass where the green blades were growing through again, tinging the vast landscape with an emerald sheen. The swirling mist moved up over the top of the Drakensberg, driven by the rising east wind. It thinned and was decaying away in the dry air at the top of the escarpment. Suddenly, there was a sound in the wind-driven silence of the sky. Quickly I moved behind the low-stunted bush growing in a hollow beside an enormous rock. With a high-pitched whistle, a dark gray, metallic spacecraft suddenly appeared and made a perfect vertical landing on a jet of orange flame. There was no reflection from the morning sun on the circular fuselage. It remained dull and colorless, like a rock against the green slopes and the blue sky beyond. Camouflaged for sky or ground, it squatted silently on the mountaintop like a bloated spider, waiting, waiting with ominous intent. No one Draken had left in such a hurry. He knew they were watching, but could protect me from them. He was also watching from just overhead. Completely invisible, this I was sure of, as I sensed his presence. Massive cumulus clouds rested on the mountains. Snowy white tops, like great cauliflower heads clear-cut against the ice-blue of sky, told me of a change to come. A circular hatch on the spacecraft popped open without a sound. The lid hinged back like a porthole, or, and I shivered at the thought, like the cleverly hinged lid of a trapdoor spider's lair. Nothing happened. A deep silence hung in the air, and only the wind whispered through the top of the bush. The spacecraft's smooth, rounded simplicity, jointed with large circular rivets, concealed a machine of tremendous efficiency and superior maneuverability. Quite globular, like a sphere, it had soft-fortedly landed on short tripod legs with wide circular bases. I could see small guidance jet nozzles barely protruding around the perimeter, while underneath, the circular rim of the burn exhaust hung between the tri-soft-pod legs. A man appeared through the hatch. He quickly slid down the ladder riveted to the fuselage and jumped to the ground. He stood still, raising his arms and running his fingers through his blonde hair. He drew in deep breaths of fresh mountain air, sighing with satisfaction as the invigorate soft-hyphening atmosphere restored his tired mind and body. He then turned to look out over the far distances of Natal beyond the rim of the escarpment with thoughts, I knew, of conquest in his heart. Another man climbed through the hatch, slid down the ladder and lay on the ground, taking in lungfuls of air. Then, closing his eyes, he slumped, spread-eagled out, into a deep sleep. They must have spent a long time in that confined space, I thought, waiting. Suddenly, the tall cosmonaut whirled round, his hand on his belt, as he saw Celine slowly making her way up the mountain path to look for me. Noting the bridle and saddle on her, he crouched down. Celine stopped and, lifting her lovely head high, she saw the strange craft and the man crouching beside it. Like a flash of white light, she turned on her hocks and bolted back down the path. The Russian stood up and deliberately took careful aim with a small tube-like weapon. "Stop!" I called out. "How dare you attempt to kill my horse?" Startled, he lowered his arm and turned to face me as I walked out from behind the bush. I was so cross that I nearly walked up to him to slap his face, but I spoke instead. "How dare you frighten Celine and point a death ray at her? Besides, she could have injured herself down that precipitous path. You have no right to land here. This is my country, not yours, and we are peaceful here." He looked so grim that I thought he would point that small weapon at me and vaporize me from the face of the earth, but his gray eyes softened as he looked me up and down. "I did not expect to meet you so soon," he answered, in perfect Ang-soft-lish with an Oxford accent. "There is nothing you can do about it," I said. "Capturing me will not help or make any difference. You can never capture the spaceship or its crew." "Then why are you here now?" he shot back as he clasped my wrist in a grip of iron. "I am often here. This is my home. You came to meet the man from another planet. He is your lover. We wish to meet him also, to ask his help with space exploration. He would not agree to meeting any nation on Earth." "Then you must stay with me until he does agree to talk with us." "You have already captured me," I quietly replied. Pulling my wrist free from his grasp, I sat down on a boulder. There was plenty of time. The groom with the pack horse would be here soon. Celine would follow them up. I could then plan to escape, as long as David remained by the lower stream as I had asked him to. I looked at the tall Russian. He was very handsome, with regular features and blonde hair. He wore very attractive sideburns, which were long, tinged with white and neatly trimmed. He had recently shaved, and I caught the fragrance of a pleasant lotion. He was middle-aged, with kind gray eyes. He would be reasonable and understanding. "You have been watching for the spaceship for some time with Ang-soft-tronic instruments," I said. "You detected it this morning in this area, so you landed hoping to surprise them. Is that not so?" "That is so. You have been ordered to capture the spaceship at all costs, even to attempt to ram it in midair. Your life as a scientist and the life of your engineer would be expendable, just so that your scientists could ground the spaceship and probe her propulsion systems to pick up clues." "But," I continued, "you people don't seem to realize that a spaceship of this nature is on automatic control immediately when the propulsion systems are switched on. It takes evasive action the moment a strange object of any kind approaches. Therefore, it is impossible to ram it. What you have been doing is to try and catch it off guard while it is on the ground with all systems switched off. Even then it is impossible to capture her, because a warning device is immediately triggered within the ship. The surrounding field differentials are set up, which nothing can penetrate, not even bullets." "That would be far too difficult," he answered. "My mission is to capture you." I bit my lip and said nothing, but shivered suddenly in the warm sun. The Russian looked concerned and immediately climbed into his craft, returning with a thick hand-knitted jersey. Putting it round my shoulders, he buttoned it up, pinning my arms to my side. "I will take care of you, and when we reach Moscow, you will be Ang-soft-tronic cared for in the clinic for exobiology research. Your child will be safely delivered by our team of scientists, who will bring up and train the space child as a great scientist. With his sire's brain, he can show us the way to the stars, as naturally he will wish to follow his people." "You have it all arranged, then?" I answered. "And what will become of me? The empty vessel. Once you have delivered the space child safely into the hands of your fellow scientists, you will work for us in the Department of Space Research. I think you are just guessing about all this." "Oh, no," the scientist said gently. "We have methods of finding out. We know everything. I never expected to get you, although I had observed you on your white mare at times. Then you used her in a clever ruse to capture me." "Yes. As a scientist and a lover of animals, I would never have harmed her, nor upset you in any way. You are the prize, with the space child developing within your womb. And if I escape? Then we will invade your country to get you. You wouldn't dare?
Oh yes, we will. This country is a rich prize that we intend to take.
I turned my back on him and looked out over the rim of the escarp soft hyphen meant just as the groom rode over the brow with Celine following on behind. The groom had had enough shocks for one day, and he busied himself with the horses. Celine tossed her head and snorted in defiance as she came to me and thrust her muscle into the small of my back, pushing me forward off the boulder. I put my arm round her neck, untied the reins and adjusted my stirrups. I called to the groom to make a fire and brew tea. The Russian's eyes widened as he watched the groom unpack pieces of kindling wood and gather stones to make a fireplace in the sandy hollow beside the great rock. Opening the large saddlebag, he brought out a tin of sandwiches and various items for tea making. After arranging the mugs on a ledge, he went to fill the bilikan from the mountain stream and soon had it boiling in the hot embers. My lady, you come with the comforts of civilization, the Russian said, sipping his tea with relish. Wouldn't your engineer like some, too? I replied. We all share alike. It is as Ulu custom. You had better wake him. The engineer's pleasant face lit up with a disarming smile, showing prominent, even teeth. His dark hair was so close-cropped that I could see the pale skin of his skull, and he wore casual civilian clothes with black sand shoes on his feet. When he had finished his tea and sandwiches, he climbed back into the craft. IME-Soft-Diately noticed a radar scanner swivel around on top of the craft as it moved into view, and I heard the static of the radio as another antenna appeared under the flange around the periphery of the craft. Well, I thought, they are all set to go. I twisted my hand in Celine's mane when the Russian said, come now, we must go. At that instant, an Air Force jet screamed across the sky. Noting the look of uneasiness on his face as he suddenly turned to watch the jet, I nodded to the groom and swung up into the saddle from a thick flat stone I had my foot on, driving my heels into Celine's sensitive side. Shocked by my action, she leapt over the bank to slither and slide down the steep trail beyond, with the groom close on our heels. Sliding down on her hocks with the scree, Celine swiftly obeyed me as I guided her in under a wide rock outcrop that overhung the trail further down. The other horses followed, pushing against each other, their sides heaving with the breath of sudden exertion and sweat streaming from their coats as if they already sensed the urgency of our flight. Except for their labored breathing, they made no sound on the damp sand of the cave floor, and I gave instructions to turn their heads to face the rock wall at the back of the cave. They remained trembling in every limb, sensing some dreadful happening. It came with a strange sound as a great boulder beside the trail outside melted away, as the craft unleashed a deadly high-energy ray from its swiveling turret. They could not reach any further, as the trail bent sharply to the right and the cave stretched well into the mountainside. All they could do now was to frighten me into submission with their diabolical weapon and this show of horrifying power. I depended on their short margin of time to remain landed on the top of the berg, for surely they would soon have to rendezvous with their space station. I had noticed the engineer pre-soft-pair for takeoff and had acted with split-second timing to escape. With perfect timing, the Air Force jet had distracted the Russian's attention. The groom had also helped, being quite wonderful and calm as he unobtrusively prepared for our sudden escape on the top of the berg. We remained silently sitting on our mounts for some time, and we only moved from our hideout when thick mist swirled up over the mountain slopes with the south wind, the blessed mist with the fragrance of eternity. Silently and slowly we made our way down the trail to the high plateau. I knew the men in the spacecraft had highly sensitive electronic instruments to pinpoint any area, now that their orbital landings had been perfected to such a degree of accuracy. I thought of the melted sandstone boulder way back up the trail, and I wondered what geologists would think if they found it. Quickening our pace, we moved across the high plateau and into the shelter of the foothills of Little Berg.
Back at the hostel hidden in the pinewood, we rested after our ordeal. Massive cumulus clouds rested on the mountains. Snowy white tops, like great cauliflower heads clear-cut against the ice blue of sky, told me of a change to come. Their base showed an ominous depth of blue-black line like a band across the foothills, gradual soft hyphen ally settling further and further down as the awe-inspiring cumulonimbus, black and frightening, scudded before a shifting wind. An eerie hush lay in the atmosphere, and all living creatures grew quiet and scurried to shill soft hyphen dir. Not a sound or breath of wind stirred in the long grass. All was deadly quiet, until from far away came the distant rumble of thunder. Celine nudged me in the back with her muscle and started to paw the ground impatiently. Turning swiftly, I mounted as she turned on her hocks and galloped away toward the stone hut. A thin wisp of smoke curled up in the far distance. Would we reach the hut in time? My thoughts gave wings to Celine, and she lowered her head, stretching out in the fantastic gallop of the Arabian. Her mane and tail streamed in the wind of her passage like a streak of light in the gathering gloom. Burying my hands in her mane, I crouched low over her with a zund, moving as one. We jumped over washaways and banks in our swift flight over the veldt. The lazily curling smoke gave me the answer. David could read the writing in the sky and had everything ready for a storm siege, even a hot meal cooking on the stove. As we raced toward it, I blessed the stone hut for its shelter and hoped it could withstand the coming onslaught. Celine checked and pulled up outside the door, her nostrils flaring wide. Quietly, she walked into the hut with me still crouched over her neck. David slammed the stout wooden door just as a bolt of lightning tore a furrow in the ground near the entrance with a whiplash explosion and crack. Glancing through the window, I saw the light outside change to a blue-green of ominous hue. The veldt suddenly ended in a dark line of oblivion. Advancing rapidly and closing in with an awful roar, the pounding hail obliterated everything in its path. I saw the sudden gale tug and claw through the scrub trees beside the mountain stream as great jagged lumps of ice bounced over the veldt. They crashed on the corrugated iron roof of the hut, denting the tough iron over our heads with indentations like craters. It sagged inward, but it held firm on the stout roofing timbers. Darkness enveloped us, and the din was a shocking crescendo of storm havoc. The oil lamp on the trestle table flamed and smoked with each gust of wind that tore at our shelter in its diabolical fury. We stacked the fire with extra wood to give us warmth against the brutal, howling soft hyphen ments without. Incessant, vicious lightning and the roar of thunder and hail never ceased for a moment. The blinding white of the lightning seared my eyes, flashing through the uncurtained window. I put on my sunglasses as protection from its glaring brilliance, and the dreadful barrage of ice came in through the window, seeking us out as if it had a mind of its own. It pounded through, splintering the wooden frames to bits and smashing against the stone lintel. We found more firewood behind the stove and stacked it in the wide window ledge to block the smashed window. Celine stood with her head down in the corner of the hut, her beautiful white body trembling with nervous tension created by the strong magnetic forces of the storm center. Every now and then she snorted her defiance at the elements. She refused the food and water placed beside her. We ate some of David's delicious stew, and the warmth of it restored our strength in the fitful glare of lightning. We kept vigil through the night with more hot stew and milk to warm us, and I blessed the builder of the hut for his foresight in constructing such a tough shelter on a knoll well above the stream, which had now added its roar to that of the storm. Completely exhausted, I curled up in the hay beside Celine. David covered me with a brightly colored Basotho blanket. Gradually, a delicious warmth spread to my feet, and I slept despite the shattering din. It was wise to leave the other horses in the shelter of the hostel. I felt we should not bring them. I awoke to peace and complete quiet. Celine was lying down in the warm hay, her head against my legs, breathing softly in her sleep. David was sitting in front of the dying embers of the fire, his tall body relaxed and serene as he gazed into the fire, keeping vigil for us. The dawn light brightened through the shattered window and the chinks of wood, and a fresh mountain breeze came through, bringing the pungent smell of bruised vegetation. Taking a deep breath of it, I stretched and then sat up,